in the course of just a few short years, a novel, American Dervish, published to wide acclaim. Then you wrote 4 plays in 8 months. One a Pulitzer Prize winner, disgraced, currently en route to Broadway. Another play, which I had the pleasure of attending last week in New York at Lincoln Center, just as masterful as disgraced, The Who and the What. The Invisible Hand, another play, the centerpiece of this coming season's New York Theater Workshop. Yeah. As well, Ed is on his way tomorrow to L.A., for talks about possibly his developing a television series. And you will be able to listen to Ayad on All Things Considered. We're still waiting to find out whether that will happen this afternoon or Monday, and we'll send something out to let you know about that. So this is a list of his recent accomplishments, but the point really is that this turn in his work, this turn, is not something that really can be summarized. And so I wanted to begin with the question. It's both a meta question and a literal question. You know me. The literal question would be, could you talk to us about these literal turns in your life, in your career, and the way in which things turn in the art that you make? But then, in a meta way, I wonder if we might end up meditating on a turn as a kind of mythos. Is this the way that we narrate our lives in retrospect? And maybe the idea of the turn is false on some level.
Honor to be here. You are my early mentor. I had you as a freshman and then sophomore. The first creative writing workshop I had was with you. You introduced me to so much. So everything I do, in a way, is an homage to your mentorship. That's just true. So I've told you before, just tell me where you want me to be and when you want me to be there, and I'll be there. So, you know what's interesting? You knew me back when, and I was a driven student and very focused. And I had a desire. I had a, you know, before meeting you, I had another teacher in high school who, I had a teacher in high school who really made me want to become a writer. And, you know, I'd grown up to, you know, the Pakistani immigrant parents, both of whom were doctors, and, you know, the idea of being a writer, it was just a, you know, very far afield. And but she made me want to become a writer, and I brought a kind of drive and a focus to that, which I think has been unabated for, I'm 43 now, that was when I was 15, so 28 years. And I liken that moment of my encounter with Ms. Durfler in high school and with the literature that she exposed me to with the moment of falling in love. I think that, you know, I have not been so lucky in matters of romance in my life. But I would say that I found a profound embodied material and spiritual love. I fell in love so fully with the literary pursuit, with storytelling, with reading, that through all of the very, very significant difficulties that I've been through over the years, because, you know, show business is a very difficult place to try to make your way, especially if you are of a minority, and then furthermore, post 9/11, a minority that is despised widely, there are challenges in the marketplace for you, and to say the least. And, of course, those challenges can be opportunities, but there are also challenges and require a lot of staying power. You know, the thing that I always say to people is, say, well, do you have any advice? I say, well, yeah. Advice is stick with it and find ways that you can stick with it, because it takes time. But what has kept me going through all of that is the fact that I never fell out of love with this thing I fell in love with. That love has only ever deepened. And so I know that that's not really an answer to your question of turns. I mean, I feel it, but I think that it's the foundation of any answer that I could have about it. I think what's happened to me in the last few years is a little perplexing even to me. I'd say that I finally found or connected to myself, or my voice, as it were. And it turns out that my voice isn't really a voice. It's more an ease.
An ease?
An ease. And trust. And trusting that I'm not questioning myself in ways that I used to. which doesn't mean I don't still have doubts or I don't still have questions about the work I'm doing or I don't still want to rework things. It's just that there's a trust that what I'm doing merits my attention and merits the audience's money. Really, I mean, you guys are paying money to see this stuff or to buy that stuff, and it better deliver in some way. And I think in a way, something we were talking about this morning at breakfast, one way of looking, you know, one way of narrating this trajectory that I've had is understanding compromise, understanding how to compromise, and understanding compromise as a necessary condition for creativity, and understanding how the situations that compromise creates are actually opportunities to make the work better. But it just takes a long time to understand this business. It's really a business.
Yeah, compromise is interesting. Charles Bernstein and I last night were talking about constraint. Right? We kind of think of it as a flight of freedom of some sort, but the constraint compromise makes possible, becomes a condition of possibility.
Yeah, it does.
I want to get back to the idea of the voice being replaced in your lexicon with an ease and love. So,
yeah.
Two things. I wonder about whether you also were falling in love with language in that high school scenario, and what would that mean? Do you consider yourself someone who's in love with language? What would that mean? I mean, what is the place between love and eros in the classroom, in your work, in your relationship to language? Mm. And then where voice is concerned, you're making me think about the way in which I was so struck by this description that you offered an interviewer from Guernica magazine for how you came to compose Disgraced. And it had to do with hearing a voice not your own, that you listened to for a very long time. And if I may just read what you
sure.
said
yeah.
here. I finished writing Disgraced at the beginning of 2009, and it had its first production in 2012, 3 years later. And I continued to rewrite it through London in 2013. So it was basically 4 years of really, really writing, constantly writing. And I'd say for the first 2.5 years, I didn't know what the play was about. I was just writing. And Amir would keep talking. And I would keep trying to understand what in God's name he was saying. And it was so strong, and it just kept going. And then I finally got it. But it really took me a whole production to understand that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I guess, you know,
well, the idea of listening or the idea of hearing, I think, is central to so many, I mean, spiritual traditions, but also creative practices. I mean, Pinter has a very famous essay about listening to his characters, and Faulkner famously used to tell students, you know, all I do is try to follow my characters around and listen to what they're saying and write it down. And I think that this idea that hearing as the more primary imaginal gateway is a very old one. You know, the old Hindu Advaita formulation that enlightenment is a sentence that you hear. Which is not a metaphor, actually. It's apparently, because I can't speak for having heard that sentence yet, it's a sentence that you hear. It's not something that you imagine or see, if you will. So the visionary gateway, or the creative gateway, at least, I think there is something about hearing that is central to that. As far as language, you know, look, language is not my strongest suit. I don't think that... No. Please. Bear with me. A prolonged meditation on the origins and the complexities of human speech are not the subject of my work. Language is a vehicle for something, and what I would say that something is a narrative experience. I wish to convey an embodied narrative experience for an audience because I feel that that's the thing that can absorb intellectually, emotionally, absorb a viewer or a reader, transport them to another place. And you know, in to use an almost religious sort of formulation, what I think I strive to do as an artist is to create a kind of union with the viewer or the reader. I want to create a sense of oneness. We gather in a room together to observe this phenomenon, this thing that's going to happen in front of us with these actors. It takes us back to our ritual roots. It takes us back to the expression of myth. And there is, in its worst embodiments, these collective arrangements, these you know, mob mentalities come from the kind of one mind, one body that a group can have when they get together. But they're at the other end of that register is also religious experience. And so I think that in a secular sort of, you know, frame, one of the things that I think that narrative can do at its best is to move people profoundly, whether to laughter or tears, and that there is a kind of renewal that can happen from that experience. And that's what I strive to do.
So maybe this is a good segue into spirituality over religion.
Sure. Let me say one more thing about love, because I think it's important.
Sure. I think you should say more than one more thing about love. Okay. What the world needs now, I think.
So I'll let you say more than one thing about love. I'll say one thing. I think that one of the wonderful things I feel that has happened to me as an artist in my career, but also in my trajectory as an artist, is I think that you know, whatever this remarkable success that has happened of late came late enough in my sort of, that it doesn't feel like it's really about me. It feels like it's about something that me and the audience, me and the are trying to do together.
Okay.
And I associate that with love. Mm-hmm. To me, it feels that there is a, and that doesn't mean that it can't be cruel or shocking or terrifying, but that it's all contained by a much larger frame that is a loving frame. And that's just something, it's not a concept so much as it is, I think, something that I have come to feel maybe through a lot of suffering over the years as an artist.
So you think that it's made possible more of a detachment from the writerly ego, and maybe when we're just starting out, we're more likely to not be able to affect away from, you know, the idea of ourselves and the idea of ourselves as being yoked to the idea of ourselves as writers, who we are, and that we are writing. And so you think that is, it was that the trials and tribulations, if you will, or you're having worked so hard for quite a long time. This, and also the way in which you think about audience, I mean, could this be a good place to pause to hear you more on audience? Because, you know, we have such a different sense of this. I'm always learning from you, and you really challenge me right where I am and what I'm trying to do in my work, too. I like to quote Gertrude Stein about audience in terms of what I'm trying to make. I always say, I'm writing for the audience that doesn't yet exist. Now, that might just be because no one's reading me that I say that. But, you know, I really stand by this idea that I don't preclude audience. I want to tutor. Great writing, the writing I like to read, is tutoring me. Mm-hmm. It's creating me as an audience. It's training me in how to read.
Right.
And so I don't want a literature that always already assumes
right
who the audience is. And yet, when you talk to me about what you're doing, I'm so compelled by it, because that ethical, responsible sense that you have that there's a reader.
Mm-hmm.
And that you must be thinking about that person, and that you want their attention. Because also, your work is an experiment on attention. So there's Gertrude Stein again. No one else will compare you to Gertrude Stein.
No, trust me, no one else will ever do that. And you may stop doing it at some point, too.
You don't want anyone to tweet that? The Broadway play might not take off. But if you could talk a little more about, I mean, I love the idea of loving.
Let me respond to what you said earlier, and let me then come back to this question of the audience. But I think, you know, as a very young writer, 15, 16, and then in my early 20s, and, you know, reading all the great sort of stuff, and my high school teacher inculcated me with this sort of, you know, Central European modernism. I read so much of that stuff and you know, thought that was what it meant to be a universal writer, you know, was to write like Kafka or Robert Musil or something like that. And I think that the idea of art or writing as self-expression, as the expression of something unique, remarkable about me, or some way to prove that to the world, some way to define myself as separate from, that was like 15 years of that I did that. And it just was awful. I mean, I was just terrible at it. Some people are really good at it. I was just really bad at it. So it was a constant proof that I was not special, that there was nothing remarkable about me, at least in the doing. And I think there was some crossing, some coming of age. Like, the real coming of age for me as an artist is this transition from art as self-expression or writing as self-expression to writing as creative engagement with the world. Mm-hmm. And a way to be with others, a way to be with the body and the soul of the world as it is. Mm-hmm. And so the world figures very strongly in the work I do now. It's not so much about stand-ins for myself or, you know, it really is about what I see happening out there and which I am a part of course. I mean, that's part of the, as far as the audience goes, I mean, the simplest way to talk about, I think, what it is that I think of as the audience is, I go on a lot about how hard a road it's been for me as an artist, not so much to sort of garner sympathy and you know, get pity, but just to sort of frame the choices that are required in order to really do what it is that we do and to do it long term and to, you know, as Kafka once said, to get to the point is to get to the point of no return as quickly as possible. So how do you get to that point of no return? And then what do you do once you're there? And so one of the attainments, if for lack of a better word, that I think that a lot of the trials and tribulations have led to for me is a much simpler sense of what it means to be human. Just a much simpler sense of what the experience of being and being alive is about. As a narrative artist, my access to that is story. When an audience feels that a story is being told to it, it wakes up in this very simple way, like a child. It's like, oh, what's going to happen next? When the audience senses there is no longer a story being told to them, or that the story doesn't make any sense or is arbitrary, there is some shutting off that happens. I know that because I sit with audiences and I feel that, but I also know it because I have that sense myself. Mm-hmm. And so if I write to that in myself, I trust I am writing to that in the audience, mm-hmm. which is an abstraction and a simplification, but is also a phenomenological reality. Mm-hmm. When we gather in a room, there is one mind, one body. Certain members of that one mind, one body choose to identify themselves as separate from it. Those are called critics. So there's always, taking this tack with an audience is going to create inherent tension with the critical sensibility. But I think that audiences are deeply, deeply intelligent. And I think they wish to be prodded and opened. But the gateway of that, in my experience with my work, is story. It's trusting the sacred covenant of anticipation, wanting to know what's going to happen next, being engaged with what's happening on stage. The challenge, the anti-narrative challenge, the modernist, postmodernist challenge, those are all really wonderful things. I have no interest in engaging in that because I don't want to problematize this simple sense of being human. I just want to get there.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think when you said that in the Guernica interview, that you don't want to problematize things. I understand what you're saying as you're right. articulating it. I think I do. But I think that formulating it that way can potentially,
sure,
you know, sell yourself short in a way, because there's no question in my mind that the work that you created is, it is as simple as it is complex, and
right.
that binary gets us in trouble sometimes. You know,
it does.
So
it does.
To say that you want to get to something simple.
Well, I want to get to a simple starting...
Something fundamental?
I want to get to something common, unreflected, unmediated by the intervening filter of the critical or interpretive faculty. And from that point, from that groundwork, that foundation, we can go somewhere together. Mm-hmm. Now, where we end up going, many people may disagree on the conclusion. Uh-huh. I mean, Disgraced is a case in point. Everybody walks out of that play thinking something different has happened, but almost, I'd say, 80% of that audience walks out of there feeling shattered. Mm-hmm. What tools they use to try to grapple with the shattering have to do with their own lives and their own experience and their own ideas about the world. Mm-hmm. I believe that reaching that emotional place underneath the discursive layer, because I'm also a believer that consciousness is pre-linguistic, I don't think that language and consciousness are the same thing, mm-hmm. which is a long debate that was now still
sure.
raging. I think if you can reach that place, the long-term effects of the work will remain. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. So I received an email some time ago from a fellow who runs one of these theater institutes about being involved with something, and we initiated a kind of email exchange, and he mentioned to me a few emails in that he had gone to see Disgraced with his partner, a Pakistani man, when it was up at Lincoln Center, and that he had taken his in-laws to go see it
all 12 in-laws. So they all went. So Pakistanis Americans all went to this play, and he said they absolutely abhorred it. I mean, they loathed it. He said, what's interesting, we're email corresponding 8 months later. He said, what was interesting to observe is over the last 8 months, they sometimes still talk about it at dinner and get into big arguments. And now half of them have changed their mind. And they think that it's a profound statement about what their experience of being Muslim in America is about.
Wow.
So that kind of staying power does not come from interpretation. It comes from affecting at a much deeper level the audience. And it's a kind of an emotional complex that gets introduced.
There's so many things that have percolated up from what you have just told us. I'm wondering, for example, about the way I think of you as working with great deliberateness. And when you talk about the choices that you make, and that this is partly what's made possible this coalescence of, mm-hmm. of work, of great work all at once. But I wonder, does accident ever figure in your composing? And I also wonder, I hear what you're saying about attention. I must wake the person up. Are they like a child?
Did I say that?
No,
I said they wake up.
You don't mean to wake them up, but
I can't.
We're talking about the way that a child wants to hear a story.
Right.
And so my question has to do with whether some shutting off could be desirable as well. And, you know, I've been to your place where I am there and riveted and every word, and they're so, again, taught.
Right, because that awakened.
I am there for all of it, but mm-hmm. could there be an argument for pause? Pause is the place of where meditation happens, where the power of the chizura. And of course, it's not as though we're saying your plays are just full of words and there's no space, because what they are, of course, are highly orchestrated. There's movement and temporality, and they're just so deftly timed. So I'm not saying that there aren't pauses or spaces, but
I mean, you know, it's always tricky to talk about one's own practice and sort of poetics and to what extent some of this is projected desire on my part and to what extent it's reality. But I think the precondition, children don't necessarily want to hear a story. Sure, they love hearing stories, but it's that some part of the brain, I think, wakes up when there is the sense that a story is being told. That's what I'm getting at. And that precondition, that attentiveness, can be a gateway for a much deeper, fuller attentiveness.
Uh-huh.
I want to create a narrative and aesthetic field in which emotional and intellectual and bodily attention, it can reach a kind of apex in its ideal. At that point, my job is done. Whatever the audience chooses to do in that heightened state with their own experience of what they've seen, that's their choice. I have no desire to dictate to them any sentence about what it is that they've seen. Mm-hmm. So that's as far as pause goes. Yeah, sure. I think that there are you have transitions, and there are moments, you know, sort of to before the climactic moment within a story. There's often a little dip in a caesura, as you would say, before we launch off into.
But you're not going to be performing John Cage's Silence anytime soon.
I mean, it's that stuff is great. I don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
You know, we can.
Accident.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Yes, I'm very deliberate, but you know, the thing is, I believe that the best prep, the more prepared you are, the more prepared you are to be surprised. And I think that you can understand how fortuitous and how beneficial a particular surprise is if you really do understand what you're doing. So, in the rehearsal room, I mean, in previews, we had 2.5 weeks of previews before we opened before we started showing the play to the critics, but we had audiences every night. I rewrote the beginning and the ending. This is a play that I'd already been working on for 1.5 years, but reworked these two essential parts of the play because it just wasn't quite, just wasn't quite right. So that's a function of the encounter with the random or, the unpredictable nature of the one mind, one body audience experience.
In your novel, Mina, the narrator's spiritual guide, says, if you hold on to the pain for too long, you start to think you are this pain, and if you think you are this pain, it means you start to think you deserve this pain. And then later in the novel, a few weeks into Mina's stay, Hyatt, now narrating, I had my first experience of her deeper sense of things, what most called her intelligence, but which I think was actually something closer to a spiritual gift. And then in your postscript to the book, you write, the book dramatizes the conflict between the points of view, three points of view on faith, the rationalist-humanist rejection of it, the literalist-orthodox accepting of it, and the personal mystical exploration of faith as a vehicle to a deeper sense of the present. And then, of course, we have in the who and the what, a major character who is questioning, who's trying to reinterpret the Quran and humanize the prophet. And so I guess, you know, buried in all of this, I'm trying to wonder about the difference, if it is a difference for you, between spirituality and organized religion, as it figures in your life and work, what it is you're trying to address.
It's a big question, above my pay grade for sure, but I can speak to it. I can speak to it from my experience. I think that, you know, folks, we often use, you know, faith in a couple different ways. One is as an identity marker, as a way of situating ourselves within the cosmos and within the sort of social landscape. You know, me growing up in Milwaukee as the only sort of, you know, Pakistani and really Indian subcontinent on that side of town for a while, trying to understand my difference, the fact that I was different from other kids, and what was the meaning of that difference? Was it a good difference or was it a bad one? Islam came to mean I am different and in a good way. So that was an identity thing. But it also quickly veered into, you know, as a kid, I had a very unusual, perhaps, sense of the splendor and wonder and depth and subtlety of experience. It was something that I recognized when reading Jonathan Edwards' personal narrative much later in life and his reflections on coming to Christ as a young boy, and the way he describes it, very, very familiar to me. And the only thing in my experience as a kid that addressed this register of experience was the Quran and Star Wars. You know, those were the only two things. It was the only two things that spoke to this level of depth in human life. And so on the one hand, it was an identity marker that told me, yes, my difference is good. And on the other hand, it was also an opening onto what is this mysterious, amazing thing that's going on all the time? This life, this thing, these trees. What is this all about? Oh, the Quran has something to say about that. And so does Yoda. So I think uncoupling the identity marking part of the experience of faith was the great project of my early adulthood, and understanding that I didn't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and I didn't have to call it Islam for it to be meaningful, and that folks talking about how they came to Christ could often be the same discussion that I was having with myself about something else. I think folks are generally very sensitive to that, irrespective of their faith and irrespective of their adherence to a particular creed or whatever.
Hearkening back to love again and the way you described that early experience, do you think a writer has to be in love with the world in order to write?
I don't think so. I think William Gaddis once wrote, when a writer runs out of rage, he runs out of the fuel to write with. So I think there are probably much greater writers than myself who have hated the world and have hated other people, but have expressed it with such refinement and uniqueness that those are contributions.
Mm-hmm. We're reinventing the world, obviously, when we write. But do you think that there has to be a fundamental belief of some sort in order even to put word to page?
Belief.
I'm not talking about religious belief.
But belief about in what?
Belief, that's what I'm asking you.
I don't know. I think faith is a very profound, maybe the most profound attitude toward life, and at least in my experience. And I think faith without an object is an action. And I think faith with an object is belief. And I think that faith without an object is the deeper orientation toward life.
Faith without an faith. Object, that sounds like writing.
And I think that's what writing can be. That's right.
I want to shift gears a little bit, but not entirely, because I wouldn't consider our conversation complete, and of course it's hopefully never complete, never finished. But without saying something about the bold and uncommon and glorious ways in which you treat what I'll call cross-identification between genders in particular. So women being at the center of some of your work, but also it's familial relations between an aunt and her nephew, and it's just so profound in American Dervish. The scene where the nephew is watching his aunt masturbate, and then she goes on, she doesn't know he's watching him, obviously. He's watching her, obviously. And then she goes on to be his spiritual guide in the who and the what, the relationship between the father and daughter, and the father trying to arrange the daughter's life, but also identifying with her.
Right.
So I was struck both by the ways in which you are able to access those relationships, and I don't see this a lot in contemporary writing, but not just to portray, if you will, the relationship between a man and a woman inside of a domestic sphere, or a boy and a woman, but that what happens between these characters is that they cross-identify, mm-hmm. which is something that we're generally not allowed to do. You know, we're supposed to maintain our coherence by knowing what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman, what it means to be white, black,
right.
etc. And so I'm just so in awe of that, as I am of so many aspects of the work that you're doing. And I wonder, how did you come to access that axis?
One of the real troubling things about my sort of leaving home and going to college for the first time was realizing how unstable my identity felt to me, and how I felt the need for approbation and reflection from others in order to know who I was. And I think that I recognized that that was a dangerous place for me to be. But I think whatever steps I took, you know, to sort of shore up that sense of self over time, I think I never lost the fundamental recognition that identity really is unstable. And yeah, I think it's true. I mean, I know it sounds Pollyanna-ish, but I think it's actually true that we kind of are all one. So any recognition or attempt to separate from that fundamental truth is the beginning of a lie by definition. Maybe a necessary one, maybe one that is very true to this plane of reality, that, you know, where you are talking to me and I am talking to you. But there's something also very mysterious going on between you and me. Mm-hmm. We met back then we meet up again. It's like no time has changed. You're still my teacher. I still love you. You now love me in this whole different way. There's some continuity that's happening between us that doesn't, I can't put a word on it, but just feels like some expression of a unity, or of some kind of long-term union. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it sounds Pollyannish, but I really believe it.
It's pretty splendid. Not Pollyannish at all. Would you be willing to take a question or two?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Because I think that would mean a lot.
Yes, sir.
Do you sit down daily to just write?
I do.
Do you have a time and a place, and you just show up and you're going to be there and you're going to do it? You don't fight it.
I had I can't remember who it was, but I do remember feeling like it came from a mentor who once said to me, if you don't show up on a regular basis somewhere, the muse will never know where to find you. So I think that's the practice, and in my case, I don't put a ton of pressure on myself to write. I'll write if I feel like it. But I've got to be feeling like it or not feeling like it at a specific place in a specific time. The internet can be a real problem. So I've got this program called Freedom, which Jonathan Franzen and Zadie Smith also use. And I think Zadie Smith talked about it in an interview. You can program your computer to be off the internet. You can't have access to the internet for a set amount of time. And it really is very helpful, actually. You know, 45 minutes at a time, or an hour, 2 hours, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Can you just speak a little bit more about the voice of the person that you heard and what that experience was like?
Sure, Amir, you mean that?
Yeah, Amir, yeah.
So in Disgraced, Disgraced is really about this character Amir, who's a corporate lawyer who has a Pakistani origins. At least his parents are from Pakistan, and had some very religious mother. Is a corporate lawyer in New York and has changed his last name and has sort of been passing himself off as Hindu, and it works at a Jewish law firm. And this comes out, you know, the fact that he has been lying about it, and he's also duplicitous in some other ways too. And much of the play takes place over the course of a dinner party where a fellow partner from his law firm is at this dinner party with her husband. And the dinner party was really the part of the play that where Amir just kept talking. It was like either some part of myself or some character. I couldn't figure out what it was that just wanted to be heard. So it was saying these things, and I was creating this circumstance for him to say these things, or he was creating circumstances to be able to say things. He just kept saying them, and at first he would say them inartfully. So over time, I started crafting this so that it was more artful. And I just couldn't understand what the insistence was. It was an expression of some kind of anger, but it was happening through discourse. And he was attacking the Quran, and he was attacking Muslims. And then I started to understand. It took me about a year and a half. This is probably anybody else would have understood it sooner than I did, but I didn't. It took me a year and a half to understand there was some expression of self-loathing going on, that he was expressing some kind of rage toward himself. Right. And so then that helped me deepen my relationship to what it was that I was hearing, and that allowed it to unfold further and began to allow it to affect the circumstances of what was happening in the play, so that other people could either bring that out more fully or recognize it themselves and begin to comment and relate to him, which then led to another deepening. And so it was layer upon layer of sort of following this primary original fire, the spark, but letting it grow through the process of consciousness about what it was over time. And one of the good things about trying to do something for a very long time is that you get better at doing it. So as I learned more about what he was doing, I could dramatize it better. I could give it more form, if you will. Is that helpful?
Yeah. Okay. So Amir had a aspect to himself that was separate from you that you were learning from.
Yes, and I think it was also some part of myself too that I was perhaps not so willing to express, or, you know, at a climactic moment in the play, he is married to a white woman, and he beats her to pulp, to a climactic moment in the play. And it was very clear to me at that point that I was acting out some profound rage, racial identification rage. I mean, it was at that point when that finally happened, I knew what was happening, that I was expressing something. It was a tough day, you know, but better to do it on the page than in real life. Yeah, better to do it on the page and then win a Pulitzer Prize than end up in jail.
Yeah, that's right.
I think someone back here.
I heard you speak last year, and I was very moved by it. And since then, I've read your work, and I continue to be moved by it. But I have one question, which is, you've been writing for a very long time. How would you say that your writing has come in relation to the politics of the last, say, 15 years? Because I know that's been a big transition from your writing, and it's been a big transition in the world, as we understand.
About 4 or 5 years after 9/11, I had that moment I was referring to earlier, where I said art fully ceased to be about self-expression and more fully became about engagement with the world. And I think the changing geopolitics had something to do with that. My own personal identity politics had something to do with that. And I think that, and at that moment, I had a real moment of inspiration. There was a burst of creativity, and I had a whole storehouse of ideas that came up. And I'm about halfway through that inspiration that came up. So I've got 4 works that I created out of that, and I've got another 4 that are still pending, that I'm still working through and still trying to get out. All of those works together, let's say 7 or 8 works, they are one gesture. That's one expressive gesture. One, it will be difficult. You know, it's one of the frustrating things for me as a writer. Of course, I'm so grateful that people are paying any attention at all, that anybody's writing any kind of article and that I get a review anywhere. I'm very grateful for. But it's also frustrating at times for folks to comment on one work as a separate thing when I know that they're all connected by this much larger picture, which is at times contradictory. You know, one work will contradict the other because I'm trying to give expression to a larger picture. So that picture is one that has been deeply informed by and is in dialogue with the very thing you're talking about, which is the changing geopolitics of the last 15 years. I don't see my role as an artist to perform a corrective for the audience. One of the things, I think one of the reasons Disgrace has been so successful is because it allows people to hate Muslims if they want to. It gives them full freedom to sort of sit there and say, you know what, I knew I was right about these people. And if they come to that conclusion, then they're going to have their own little thorny nub that they got to work through. Because that's not a conclusion that is fully supported by the text and will be undermined over time.
As the six people you talked about.
Right, exactly. Wow. And so, but having that freedom in the text is important to allowing the audience to be what it is going to be in relation to what I am going to show it. So I don't feel that I have to perform, as I said, a corrective. I think that that's a public relations matter. I think it speaks to the impoverished the impoverished role of art in our culture, that art has come to be seen as some kind of a public relations thing, that it's about making people think differently about other people. And that's all great, but that's not what art is really about. Art is about something else, I think, much more problematic. You know, as Adorno once said, every great work of art is a criminal act. So it's a challenge. You know, Percy Shelley, all unacknowledged legislators of mankind are the poets and philosophers. There is some way in which we are moving spirit that's not about making people feel better. Anyway.
I think that's a really great place to pause, actually, and we want to have time to collect ourselves to be ready to hear Charles Bernstein, who will be delivering our first keynote in about 10 minutes. But I guess I want to close by saying, to return to our meeting again, and just to say you are here, we are here, it's a gift. I really will never forget last year meeting you at the Kingston train station after many years. And I suppose I want to say that this mutual gifting is as much about art as it is about the art of pedagogy. And maybe we can end on that note of love and looking forward to these masterworks that I really think are already changing the way that we proceed in our lives and think about very major current matters. Thank you, A.M.